The 2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 223, To Set in Order the House of God, The Search for the Elusive One Mighty and Strong, a paper presented by William Shepherd, with a response by William D. Russell.
Good morning. Welcome to this session on the exploration of the doctrine of the One Mighty and Strong. And I can promise you that there will be a surprise announcement at the end about who that one really is. And the tension will mount during the session because, in addition to announcing the One Mighty and Strong, the runner-up will be the One Wimpy and Weak. So you're all here at a historic occasion. Now, Bill Shepherd, our presenter, is of Strangite heritage, and I tried to get him to tell me what his priesthood office is or whether his local congregation lets him do anything, and he fudged. So I think he really belongs here at Sunstone. He's an ardent Mormon historian and has participated in many sessions of the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association, as well as Sunstone, where he did a couple of great sessions last year on violence in Mormon history. He's fascinated, he says, by the diversity of beliefs about the One Mighty and Strong in all of the Restoration churches. And as you know, that's a key scripture for many charismatic, schismatic groups, and some of which they'll talk about today. His presentation today is an excerpt from a longer paper that will be printed this year in the Community of Christ publication, Restoration Studies 8. And Herald House used to publish that, and I'm not quite sure how we'll find out that it's ready, but I'm pretty sure it will be announced in the MHA newsletter. So you can probably find out about it through the John Whitmer Historical Association website or the MHA website. Bill is on the program committee for the John Whitmer Historical Association meeting this fall, and it is a wonderful lineup of material. So if you have an interest in Mormon history, you should definitely check out the website and get more information on the program. Bill is also working on a William Smith bio, and I invite you to notice that that means Bill Shepherd is working on Bill Smith, and Bill Russell is responding to him. So can the collection agency be far behind? And he's also a specialist on crime in Nauvoo. Then our respondent is Bill Russell, who claims that he was born of goodly parents, although his parents have neglected to corroborate that, and has been on the faculty at Graceland University since 1966, where he teaches, among other things, the Book of Mormon class and the LDS history class and the racism and discrimination class, and was recently responsible for voting against continuing the presence on campus of a young Mormon student who had sprayed graffiti, anti-gay graffiti, all over the campus, but as a result of Bill's strong discouragement of his academic career, he went on a mission. So the Lord works in mysterious ways with a little help from Bill Russell. Bill claims to have authored many articles and reviews in professional journals, in Restoration Studies, the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal, Sunstone Dialogue, the Journal of Mormon History, Brigham Young University Studies, and the Saints Herald. He has also had articles rejected by all of these publications. Bill served as the president of the Mormon History Association and also president of the John Whitmer Historical Association. And where's the sentence about Lois? Here we go. And Bill was going for the record in the Community of Christ for being the longest, the oldest deacon in the history of the church. But he married a good woman who shaped him up, and you'll notice that his wardrobe has improved markedly since that time. And Bill is now an active elder in the Community of Christ, and Lois is also an ordained elder in the priesthood, and Both of them have an interest in peace and justice issues and are great supporters of GALA, which is the gay and lesbian organization for members of the Community of Christ. And Lois is a specialist in presiding, planning and presiding over worship services at the Community of Christ, and I just wish we could get her out at Sunstone one of these times. Well, I'll now turn the time over to our presenters, and they have planned their presentation so that there will be time for a question and answer period later.
Maybe I could start by giving you a hint who I think the One Mighty and Strong might be. You see this handsome silver-haired gentleman here, Melvin Smith. He was actually called to that office by a fundamentalist masseuse.
You
want to
take a good look at me? There's something else about
that. The 1876 revision of the Doctrine and Covenants by Orson Pratt at the direction of Brigham Young is remarkable for several reasons. Pratt published revelations in the order in which they were received, revised some of the introductory titles, and separated the revelations into verses. He also excluded the article on marriage and added 26 new sections. One of the added sections, section 85, was a portion of a Joseph Smith letter written at Kirtland, Ohio, to William W. Phelps of Independence, Missouri, on 27 November 1832, which Pratt considered to be a revelation. This letter excerpt contained information about an individual known only as the One Mighty and Strong, who was to sit and order the house of God. Strangely, we are not told who this individual will be when he is going to perform this wonderful work, what sitting in order means, and criteria by which we can determine if the sitting in order has been completed. We are told this individual will hold a scepter of power in his hand, and he will be clothed with light for a covering. Both of these attributes have resulted in speculation about what they mean. To further confuse the issue, the letter excerpt continued with the prediction, quote, that man that places forth his hand to steady the ark of God shall fall by the shaft of death, unquote. It is unclear if the latter individual is to be the One Mighty and Strong or is another unidentified person. All Restoration churches have been impacted by schisms inspired or justified by the three verses taken from Doctrine and Covenants 85, 6 through 8, briefly. Yea, thus say the still small voice which whispereth thought and pierceth all things, and oft times it makes my bone to quake while it makes manifest saying. And it shall come to pass that I, the Lord God, will send one mighty and strong, holding the scepter of power in his hand, clothed with light for a covering, whose mouth shall utter words, eternal words, while his bowels shall be a fountain of truth, to set in order the house of God, and to arrange by lot the inheritance of the saints whose names are found in the names of their fathers and of their children enrolled in the book of the law of God. While that man who was called of God and appointed that putteth forth his hand to steady the ark of God shall fall by the shaft of death, like as a tree that is smitten by the vivid shaft of lightning. The 27 November 1832 letter was dictated by Joseph Smith to his scribe Frederick G. Williams in Kirtland, Ohio, and was mailed to William W. Phelps, a leading high priest at Zion or Independence, Missouri. Phelps printed part of the letter in the January edition of the church newspaper, Independent, under the heading, "Let Every Man Learn His Duty." The long excerpt from the prophet's letter, which included the information about the One Mighty and Strong, was printed without commentary. In the context, it was for the saints of Zion at that time. The letter was also printed in the Times and Seasons in October 1844 and the Millennial Star in June 1852 without explanation. Sidney B. Sperry, a former professor of Old Testament languages and literature at BYU, and an authority in the Doctrine and Covenants, explained, quote, "The words in verse 7 and 8 have over the years created a virtual storm of discussion, and wide differences of opinion still exist as to their interpretation." The late Ogden Kraut, a respected Mormon fundamentalist, printed valuable information about the One Mighty and Strong. It would be difficult to estimate the number of those who have claimed the grand title of the One Mighty and Strong. Some do not make an outright claim to the title, but they do say they have, quote, all the keys that could qualify them to hold such a position. Each has said he has a special calling to bring about the work of setting the house of God back in order. Most of these individuals have been dissenters from the LDS Church, quoting from Ogden, proclaiming the reasons why the church needed to be set in order, and naturally each has claimed authority to accomplish the task. Usually he claims revelation from God, assuring him that he has been appointed, and many may have portfolios of over 100 revelations to prove their credentials. There is an admixture of names, titles, and offices under the banner of the One Mighty and Strong. Some claim that all these titles apply to just one person, while others claim that different men will hold the various titles, and he names the root of Jesse, a man likened to Moses, the Marred servant, the Lamanite prophet, and the Indian Messiah, giving references. H. Michael Marquardt, in his recent study of the development of the Doctrine and Covenants, interpreted verse 7 with its reference to the One Mighty and Strong. He says it is Joseph Smith, and the person mentioned in verse 8, who is to put forth his hand to steady the Ark of God, was a reference to Bishop Partridge. Lyndon Cook, in his book, The Revelations of the Prophet Joseph Smith, cited a 1 January 1834 letter from Oliver Cowdery to John Whitmer, which provided a different identification of the individual who was to steady the Ark of God. Quote, Brother Joseph says that the item in his letter that says that a man shall be called and so forth and puts forth his hand to steady the Ark of God does not mean that anyone had at that time, but it was given as a caution to those in high places to beware lest they should fall by the shaft of death. Unquote. And the person that we think should have the best definitive answer on this, William W. Phelps, who received a letter, determined that in a letter to Brigham Young on 6 May 1861, he explained that to Brigham Young that the One Mighty and Strong will be the resurrected Father Adam. An example of the belief that the leaders of the LDS Church were out of favor with God is found in George Q. Cannon's 29 October 1892 discourse. Quote, I have heard more of new prophets and revelators and their revelations than I have heard for several years. I did not know how many prophets I have heard of who have arisen. I do not know how many revelations I have heard of that have been given, but there have been quite a number. Many revelations have been sent to me by persons who claim the right to preside over the church and to be the prophet of the church. President Taylor has been the recipient of a number of similar communications, each one setting forth his claim to the presidency of the church and to the prophetic office, and some of them requiring us to accept the author as a person whom God has designated to be the revelator and the president of the church. Unquote. The LDS Church attempted to put all of this to rest in 1905 when Samuel Eastman and John T. Clark were claiming to be the ones mighty and strong. Joseph F. Smith, John R. Windler, and Anton H. Lund attempted to give the membership a definitive interpretation of DNC 85, 6 through 8. They explained that the mission of this individual would be in the future. Quote, when the man who shall be called upon to divide into the saints their inheritance comes, he will be designated by the inspiration of the Lord to provide authorities to the proper authorities of the church, appointed and sustained according to the order provided for the government of the church. Unquote. In essence, what they said was, an authorized prophet stood at the head of the church. This precluded any inspired individual from doing any work without the provision and supervision of the First Presidency. After acknowledging some of the brethren speculated that the One Mighty and Strong would be the resurrected Joseph Smith, the complete 27 November 1832, Smith to Phelps' letter was examined and explained. They then seemingly contradicted their conclusion that the mission of the One Mighty and Strong would occur in the future by saying the letter solely related to, quote, the affairs of the church in Missouri, the gathering of the saints to that land, and obtaining of their inheritances, unquote. Furthermore, Bishop Edward Partridge was positively identified as the one called and appointed to provide by lot to the saints their inheritance, and the person who would die by the shaft of death. Strangely, they again contradicted themselves and said their presidency further confused the issue when they explained, that's, quote, if, however, there are those who still will insist that the prophecy concerning the coming of the One Mighty and Strong is to be regarded as relating to the future, let the Latter-day Saints know that he will be a future bishop of the church who will be with the saints in Zion, Jackson County, Missouri, when the Lord shall establish them in that land. This effort to clarify things obviously only confused things. The fundamentalists jump all over this letter. One aspect of the letter that they said, Orson Pratt, then church historian and apostle, testified in the public discourse, quote, about the time of the death of Joseph, President Young. This individual would be Bishop Partridge. There probably is no letter in existence. Extensive searches of BYU, the Doctrine of Discourses, the archives, has turned up nothing about this claim. However, it is common knowledge that Orson Pratt said in the Tabernacle at Logan on 1 November 1879 in the Journal of Discourses, you may perhaps ask, when this time will come for the saints to receive bona fide inheritances. The time will come for the saints to receive their stewardships when they shall return to the lands from whence they have been driven. But the inheritances will not be given until the Lord shall first appoint to the righteous dead their inheritances, and afterwards the righteous living will receive theirs. This you will find recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants in the same book. It is predicted that there is to be a One Mighty and Strong as well as an immortal personage, one that is to be clothed with light as a garment, one whose bowels are the fountain of truth. It's very important that Pratt really believed that this resurrected individual will be Joseph Smith in other references. There are many people in the LDS tradition that have been identified as the One Mighty and Strong. That's really not the scope of this paper. Ogden Kraut gave a limited list in his day. James Brighouse, Samuel Eason, Paul Fell, Leroy Wilson, John Tanner Clark, Benjamin LeBaron, Joel LeBaron, John Bryant, Eldon Hollis, Sherman Russell Lloyd, Frank Miller, Jasper, number 7, Art Bula, and Alonzo Langford, and many, many more. If you want to see Art Bula, look under the One Mighty and Strong on the Internet. The RLDS tradition is really neat, too, because the RLDS made a mess of this, too, just like every... just like every church has. In the RLDS tradition, this belief may have originated in a revelation received by Jason W. Briggs, one of the founders of the Reorganized Church, on November 18, 1851, which promised in due time God, quote, would call upon the seed of Joseph Smith and bring forth one, and he shall be mighty and strong. The RLDS really used this to hammer the Brighamites, saying that young Joseph Smith is the One Mighty and Strong to set the house of God in order. Young Joseph never comes out and says, that's not me. but he lets everybody else say it for him. It was really a good bludgeoning instrument. For instance, one example of this is God foreknew the character of Sister Emma Smith, that she would be faithful and true to him who had called her, and he elected her to be the mother of the successor of the martyr, the one mighty and strong, who is to sit in over the house of God and arrange by the lot the inheritance of the saints, the man who shall lead them like as Moses led the children of Israel, and who, when sin of God would find the saints in bondage from which they should be led out by power and with an outstretched arm. In 1880, Apostle William W. Blair goes further. He said the reorganized church was founded on the grand revelation of the One Mighty and Strong. And part of his thesis is this, and it's kind of hard to follow, really. We may boldly affirm and challenge judgment of a council of experts in history that this famous prophecy embodied in this letter in question was not, as now headed in the Doctrine and Covenants by Orson Pratt and others, as section 85, quote, revelation given through Joseph Smith in Kirtland, Ohio, November 27, 1832, concerning the saints in Jackson County, Missouri. That the prophecy itself was incidental in the letter, that it was originally given to Joseph himself rather than through Joseph to the church through Phelps, that the prophecy of the One Mighty and Strong did not directly concern those then in Jackson County, but rather people who to this day have not set their foot in Jackson County, the children rather than the fathers, and that the mission foreshadowed related to his son Joseph, who, like his father, should be sent in the spirit of the One Mighty and Strong to restore the house of God to order after it shall have been ruled out of order and the fathers plucked out of the land of Zion because of their iniquities. The LDS really, of course, didn't like this, and they retaliate. You have no idea of the amount of verbiage and hostility between these bodies in this fight. Joseph Fielding Smith replied in 1909. That's the way they formally gave it, but they have been forced to recede because their president has not come up to the standard of the one spoken of in the prophet's revelation. Therefore, they have since 1900 resolved, quote, whereas we have received no divine communication authorizing any particular interpretation of the revelation before us, and as the reorganized church has never taken action on this matter, resolved that we leave it an open question to be decided as God may develop his purposes among us, while we acknowledge the leading features of it to be prominently characteristics of Jesus Christ. Young Joseph writes, for example, in 1905, quote, I do not personally claim to be the One Mighty and Strong, unquote. The following year, he writes, I am not prepared to state who is the One Mighty and Strong, that is, who he is as a person. There has been much speculation about it, and some have affirmed and defended by evidences and arguments that I am the one. This I neither affirm nor deny. For this reason, I believe the statement in this letter to Phelps has been much overestimated in importance. We know about the transition of the RLDS away from what were considered traditional values, and in the changes left many of the more conservative members very angry. And I quote in this article from Bill Russell, in the years since the women's ordination revelation was announced, many separatist branches and congregations have been organized. At the present time, I have identified more than 200 independent local groups in 32 states, Canada, and Australia. 55 of these groups are in Missouri, many in the Independence area. Other states with large numbers of such groups are in Michigan, Oklahoma, and Texas. And I'm sure the number is hugely more fractionalization at this time. Add to that Grant McMurray being a non-Smith, being placed in charge, provide additional stress in the RLDS Church. It's against this background of a reassessment and change that many RLDS fundamentalists long for a deliverer to be sent by God to, quote, set the house of God in order. Many of these people initially say that the church has been held captive a long season and we need the one mighty and strong. However, when the one mighty and strong has recently come to the RLDS under the leadership of Fred Larson, the 70-year-old son of Frederick M. Smith, the people weren't satisfied with that in general. Many flocked to him, but others say, no, that can't be true, because his lineage comes through a woman. It's got to come through a man, and only the one mighty and strong will be Jesus Christ. Need to wrap up. In my opinion, the weight of evidence suggests Joseph Smith's references to the one mighty and strong were not intended to be a traditional revelation. It appears to have been an inspired message with specific parameters which were to be completed within a limited time period in Jackson County, Missouri. The primary participants in this drama, Joseph Smith, William W. Phelps, and Edward Partridge, considered the information about the One Mighty and Strong to refer to events in Zion in late 1832, early 1833, and after that time it was not an issue. Let me hasten to say that if I would stand up in my church and say what I've said here, I would get in big trouble, because everybody knows that James J. Strang was the one mighty and strong. It is difficult to generalize about many topics related to Mormon history. It is safe, however, to assume individuals will continue to claim that they are the one mighty and strong. Another certainty is churches will continue to vigorously defend themselves against these deliverers who tell the membership the leadership is apostate and God has sent them to take their place. This was a perfect revelation for confusion. Open-ended, confusing, and truly in every branch of the restoration it has done a great deal of time. And as I close, I really am starting to put my weight behind Melvin Smith.
Well, the reason I've got this Beaver Island T-shirt on, which I bought 2 months ago when we visited Beaver Island, my wife and I, and nine relatives, two reasons. One, as Lamina pointed out, my wife Lois has really been sharpening up my wardrobe, and this reflects that. And then secondly, with Bill's Strangite heritage, then I thought this would be the appropriate garb for the day today. Also, I highly recommend a visit to Beaver Island. If you're wanting, I can see why Strang went there. No better place to get away from the world than Beaver Island. And so, if you're being harassed like Strang probably felt like he was, then that was the perfect place to go. So, if any of you have any demons that you need to get away from, I highly recommend Beaver Island. I've heard some mentioning a few this weekend, I think. Anyway, but to correct the record here and get things straight. Now, I do welcome this chance to be a commentator on the subject of the One Mighty and Strong. And I've thought about this for a long time, and I'm now ready to take advantage of this opportunity to announce publicly that I am the One Mighty and Strong. Despite these claims that Melvin Smith and Bill Shepherd are making, and I'm the one prophesied by Joseph Smith in 1832 in section 85. You know, if that doesn't prove it, I don't know what will. And I know Richard Dutcher here probably needs to identify who the One Mighty and Strong is. Going to know that's going to be one of his future films. I really hadn't given this subject much thought, of course, until I received light that I was the One Mighty and Strong. But sometimes doubts have come about. Some days, I feel like I'm mighty but not strong, and then other days, strong but not mighty. We all have our ups and downs. This week, every single day in Salt Lake City, I've felt mighty and strong. So I think this is the time to go for it. Off and on for the past 15 years, I've been doing research and writing this book on the schism in the RLDS Church that Bill quoted an article I'd written related to this, and which came to a head with the ordination of women in 1985. From time to time, I would hear or read RLDS fundamentalists refer to the One Mighty and Strong. I was fairly fuzzy as to where this all came from, as many of my RLDS, now Community of Christ, friends, I think most of us are pretty fuzzy about where this all came from. The main reason for our fuzziness is the fact that your Section 85 is not in our Doctrine and Covenants. You added it in 1876, long after we'd split. It is, however, mentioned in our official 8-volume church history. So some of our people have picked up on it from that source. And as Bill said, fundamentalists have really run with it. Quite naturally, it's the RLDS fundamentalists who do get excited about it. Liberals like me are happy that the LDS Section 85 is not in our Doctrine and Covenants, as the idea of the One Mighty and Strong has little or no appeal to moderate or liberal members of the Community of Christ. So we're not inclined to take something like this seriously at all. Long before I was asked to comment on Bill's paper, I did, because of the work I was doing, I decided I need to get better acquainted, though, with the One Mighty and Strong, despite my disinterest in the subject. So I emailed my friend and faculty colleague at Graceland, 70 Ron Smith, a math professor who's now in one of our splinter groups, the Mount Airy Restoration Branch. And Ron knew of the reference in our history of the church, but apparently didn't know that it was in LDS Section 85. Apparently in our history of the church, we failed to mention that it's in the Utah Doctrine and Covenants. They probably didn't want to detract from its authority. So Ron responded to me with these words. He said, "There is an 1832 Joseph Smith pronouncement from church history that a number of Mormons have picked up on." Well, he clearly doesn't know it's in the Utah Doctrine and Covenants, or he'd know that Mormons have done more than just pick up on it. So then I also emailed Lee Kilpack, the president of the 12 Apostles, in one of the other major splinter groups that's developed in the last few years, and asked him about the One Mighty and Strong. And let's see, I've got him down here. Yeah, he said, he's the one that had the revelation that really created the remnant Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, like I say, one of the strongest of our splinter groups. And his revelation ended with the statement, "Be faithful, little flock, and in my time I will send you one mighty and strong," again, Joseph Smith III being the last one, "to be your president, prophet, seer, and revelator." And not long after Kilpack's revelation, Fred Larson, who Bill mentioned, grandson of Fred M. and great-grandson of Joseph III, stepped forward to take the role of the president and prophet of the remnant church, thereby fulfilling the prophecy of their apostle. Kilpack also refers to Jason Briggs, his 1851 revelation that led to the development of the RLDS church. And Briggs had said in his revelation, "And in my own time, in my own due time, will I call upon the seed of Joseph Smith, and will bring one forth, and he shall be mighty and strong, and he shall preside over the high priesthood of my church." So Kilpack, writing in December 2001, concludes, "It seems to me that an interesting parallel exists between Joseph Smith III and the work that needs to be done today by another One Mighty and Strong." And within a year, Fred Larson was identified as that one. Ron Smith, my 70 colleague at Graceland, pointed out the passage in Isaiah chapter 28, verse 2. Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one. The Lord hath a mighty and strong one, which as a tempest of hail and a destroying storm, as a flood of mighty waters overflowing, shall cast down to the earth with the land. And I think, given Joseph Smith's fondness for Isaiah, it seems to me that this passage could well have been what stimulated the whole idea of the one mighty and strong that ended up in section 85 of your DNC. Ron Smith goes on to say that for the RLDS fundamentalists like himself, many combine the Isaiah reference with the choice seer prophecies of the inspired version, that is the Joseph Smith translation, and of the Book of Mormon. Some say this refers to Jesus, some to Joseph Smith, and others say the prophecy is yet to be fulfilled. It seems to me that Joseph Smith was referring to himself. Ron then cites from Genesis in the inspired version and from the Book of Mormon. And he reads from the inspired version, Genesis 50, 26, and 27, which again are unique to the inspired version. So it's what I call part of the Joseph Smith canon, the things that Joseph wrote, which are in the scriptures. A seer shall the Lord my God raise up, who shall be a choice seer unto the fruit of my loins. Thus saith the Lord God of my fathers unto me, a choice seer will I raise up out of the fruit of my loins, out of fruit of thy loins, and he shall be esteemed highly among the fruit of thy loins, and unto him I will give commandments that he shall do a work for the fruit of my loins. Big on the fruit of the loins, his brethren. And then, let's see, where am I at here? Then Ron cites from the Book of Mormon. Yeah. And these are RLDS references, so your references would be different. So in 2 Nephi, 2nd chapter, for Joseph truly testified, saying, a seer shall the Lord my God raise up, who shall be a choice seer unto the fruit of thy loins, of my loins. Yea, Joseph said truly, thus saith the Lord unto me, a choice seer will I raise up out of the fruit of thy loins, and he shall be esteemed highly among the fruit of thy loins. I think Susan Staker's article in the recent book, a collection of essays, American Apocrypha, on the choice seer in the Book of Mormon is an excellent source for you to really get a fuller understanding of the choice seer in the Book of Mormon. Also there's the Book of Mormon references, other Book of Mormon references that I have, which are not quite mighty and strong, but close to it. Alma 21, and Moroni was a strong and a mighty man. Mosiah 5, Ammon being a strong and a mighty man. Ether, Shula waxed strong and became mighty. And then Ether 4, two unidentified mighty men, although they're not strong. And then in the Doctrine and Covenants, our section 65, your section 65, which I'm pretty sure we have too. Anyway, it's in DNC, I think, of both of us. A voice as of one sent down from on high who is mighty and powerful. So I think, you know, all these mighty and strong things come from the Joseph Smith canon. They're not in the Bible, as far as I can tell, except for the picking up on Isaiah 28, one verse there. So they're from the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, and in his new translation of the Bible. And I think the one mighty and strong, Joseph, is bolstering his prophetic role. And I think it's, anyway, for a, let me see where I'm at here. Anyway, understandably, you never hear of the one mighty and strong in the sermons and testimonies of the community of Christ these days. If someone submitted an article for the Herald, which took the matter seriously, I think the editors would pitch it immediately and wonder about the author's head. And for a sect movement, though, you know, the RLDS Church in the early years was a sect trying to recover the Kirtland theology and dump the Nauvoo stuff. For a sect, it's understandable that it would play up upon the one mighty and strong and the choice seer, so forth. And so for the RLDS fundamentalists today, it's understandable that they would play it up and the community of Christ would pretty much ignore it. Often in prayer services over the years when I was young, you would hear people say, God will raise up another people if you're not going to get serious and build Zion and so forth. And so fundamentalists pick up on this now. It's natural for the leadership to belittle these sorts of things. Even those leaders in organizations which still have a magic worldview mentality. I hate to agree with the first presidency of either church, but I'll have to agree with the 1905 Deseret News statement that Bill cited, where they said the One Mighty and Strong has been used by vain and foolish men to bolster up their vagaries of speculations and their desire for a high position in the church. So anyway, whom do I say that he is? He ain't nobody. Joseph is talking about himself. And if he was predicting some future figure, I wouldn't take it seriously. I mean, I would almost beg you not to take it seriously. It could only divide, egos. Melvin and me, and who knows who might claim, Kent and Richard and all sorts of people, Michael, Charlie, you'd have a lot to choose from. And so so I think it can only be divisive, and so therefore I hereby renounce my claim to be the One Mighty and Strong.
One thing I didn't touch on, the little handouts I gave you, you might look, excuse me, in 85-7, Pratt inserted two footnotes. Which in 1879 to 1920, these footnotes were in the LDS Doctrine and Covenants. And when Pratt said, the One Mighty and Strong will be a future immortal individual, the note G preceded, send One Mighty and Strong. And Pratt explained in the footnote, a future messenger promised. Note 8 preceded light for a covering, whose mouth shall utter eternal words. And the footnote contained brilliant and glorious in coloring. I think the LDS folks, this was probably written by B.H. Robert and just signed. And I think Roberts did a terrible disservice to the LDS church because he overlooked what Pratt really believed, saying that Pratt said something else.
Well, I hope you noticed that Bill Shepherd just about choked to death when Bill Russell stood up and announced that he was a strong contender for this office.
So
that's right. So, but Bill Russell has now renounced his claim and Mel, did you have an announcement at this point?
No, I have an announcement.
You betcha. And then we'll have...
I am a great-grandson of Samuel Harrison Smith. And I'm the father of 9 children, and my youngest daughter toyed with the idea of getting into the fundamentalist organization, which led me to attend a workshop in, it wasn't on religion, in Mesa, Arizona. And out of that, I was introduced to this fellow in the fundamentalist group, Robert Fifield. And he was a kind of a naturopathic physician. So I had a little soreness in my back, and so he proceeded to take me to his office and work on me. And after a bit, began to express this real affection for me, both physically and verbally, and told me that he had it had been revealed to him that I was the One Mighty and Strong. I was getting weaker all the time. But this was during the time that President Edward Taft Benson, and I had some run-in with his son Reed when he was head of the John Birch Society and came to Dixie College and so forth. So I felt that there was some need for some correction in terms of the leadership on that particular issue anyway. So lo and behold, then pretty soon my daughter, my youngest daughter, and another fellow who were considering this this movement by this Robert Fifield came back in. And, of course, we all know that truth is established in the mouth of 2 or 3 witnesses. I'd had Brother Fifield's testimony, and lo and behold, here's my youngest daughter testifying that I am the One Mighty and Strong. Of course, around her, I had been pretty mighty and strong. So she...
Well, at least you declined that particular one. Okay, we're now ready to entertain some questions on this particular historic doctrine and some of its manifestations. And there, I do know that Bill has much more information than he was able to present on the role that this particular scripture has played in schismatic movements. So are there questions, comments? You're all just stunned into immobility. Yes, please. And then, if you want to address, one to Bill Russell, go ahead.
I talked to Michael Quinn via internet, and asked him if we could get a long session and get him to come and explain some of the damage that have been done by people proclaiming to be the One Mighty and Strong. He didn't have time to do this. I'm not terribly well versed with the One Mighty and Strongs within the LDS Church, although I'm sure Levina would know that better than I. Yes, ma'am.
Well, ask the person.
I think it was in 1979. One of my very best friends, very well educated, started studying with one of those names that you mentioned. Well, she didn't get that down on paper, but anyway, she went with. She left her husband and six children to go with John Bryan.
Did you have more to say about?
I became associated with John Bryan. I was instrumental in part Bulla getting into the Bryan group, and then our Bulla went off on his own to be the One Mighty and Strong.
Art Bulla has a beautiful website, a lot of music and angels, and he does. I would like to say Ann Wild, I always call her Annie, but she, if you want to read some really good work about the One Mighty and Strong, she would have reference to Ogden's work, which was really a good work. Anything else? It seems like to me that within the fundamentalist movement there are people like Ogden Kraut who says that there will be the resurrected Joseph Smith. Ogden didn't try to take charge of anything from what I could see, but there are many that do say that really jumped all over him. You should see the revelation that Bulla had about Ogden Kraut. It wasn't really nice, because if Ogden Kraut is right, then Bulla is wrong. So... Anybody know? Let me say that my studies of all the Restoration churches, for instance, the Hedrickite church, has been fractured by One Mighty and Strongs. There's a One Mighty and Strong in the Church of Jesus Christ with the Elijah message or something like that. That's the resurrected John the Baptist, who is the One Mighty and Strong. The Strangites really had some bad problems with a person who didn't call himself the One Mighty and Strong. But he wasn't smart enough to know it. But he would have if he could have read that. But so, very serious that these people that want to usurp authority, and the tradition is one, the church is out of order. Only I can put the church back in order. Seriously. And this creates horrible, horrible problems. And what I know of the Strangite problem, other problems, many of these people might not be playing with a full deck. Some that do want power, and they want women.
Gail, why don't you take just a few minutes and explain how this scenario played out in the Strangite Church?
Yeah. The Strangite Church is down to probably 70 or 80 members at this point in time. In the 1980s, we had an individual that, a person from Missouri that was rather uneducated, but he had a great use of words and a great ability to sway people. And his attack was very gradual, that seriously, the church is out of order, that something's wrong. And as time went on, he convinced people that he was the only person that could straighten this up. So the result was a massive, for our little church, a massive, disastrous schism that destroyed families, that threatened to destroy the little church. And 10 years later, people were able to get their wits back about them and stagger back into the movement, although many didn't. So it's really a horrible thing, and you can certainly be deceived.
I can add to that. Go ahead. I assume you're talking about somebody initial J.H.?
Okay. Well, anyway, Bill might be interested. When I visited Beaver Island this summer, one evening, several of my relatives and I sat on the porch of the Historical Society in Beaver Island and talked about Strang and so forth. All we needed was a spittoon and chewing tobacco, you know, to really. But anyway, Bill Cashman's really knowledgeable, I think, and he said that one certain individual that you know I'm talking about plans to move back to Beaver Island in 2006. His name's John. Okay, I think one moment his name then. And so anyway, Bill Cashman, the historian up there, said that this fellow's planning on moving back to Beaver Island in the year 2006, which is the sesquicentennial of the assassination of Strang. And I thought you might know this. He's not in jail at that time. He's been arrested before, but he's not in jail. I thought you might be interested in that. I might make a quick comment about the restoration splinter groups as far as not necessarily the one mighty and strong, but
people in a little bit on Fred Larson.
Okay. The most prominent one in the restoration splinter, RLDS splinter groups is Fred Larson, mentioned, you know, in Bill's paper, grandson of Fred M. Smith, for the president, and who was, you know, prophesied to be the one mighty and strong who would arise. Paul Edwards' cousin, in case you know Paul. So he's aspired to leadership in the church for a long time. Back in the mid-70s, he anticipated that Wallace B. Smith would name him a counselor in the presidency. Wallace became the president. But anyway, that didn't happen. So now he's the one mighty and strong and the president prophet of the remnant church. But anyway, within the splinter groups, there's been a number of people who had different conceptions of how the church should be brought back to order. And I'd say the more rational ones have been much of the 70s thought we should lead in restoring the church, because there's the three presidencies of the first presidency and the 12 and the 70s, and the first two presidencies are out of order, so we, the 70s, should get things going again. The high priests have started this remnant church with Fred Larson, and they felt the high priest should get things going together because they found something else in the DNC. There might be an RLDS DNC, you know, from Joseph III that suggested maybe the high priest would kind of lead things. The elders thought, well, the first conferences of the church back in the 1830s were elders' conferences, so the elders should get the church back in order. Jeff Lundgren, the future mass murderer, was a priest, and he was saying, the Melchizedek priesthood has screwed things up badly. All the Melchizedek priesthood, so the priests, led by me, of course, should get things back in order. And then there's various other individuals who thought, just felt individually called. And one of the more bizarre ones, I think, is that Ron Luff, who's now doing 150 years in prison in Ohio for his involvement in the Lundgren case, just a humble little guy from southern Missouri, his wife thought, Ron, you're the one mighty and strong. I'm not sure if he was mighty and strong, but you're the one, the prophet, to call us back to order. Ron said, no, it's not me, it's Jeff Lundgren. And so they followed Jeff Lundgren, and now they're in prison. His wife for 25 years. But anyway, he should have taken his own calling seriously. And if Ron had been the prophet, he wouldn't have murdered anybody, I'm sure of it. So anyway, there's a variety of approaches to setting the church back in order in among the RLDS fundamentalist splinter groups.
How much? Okay. My heart really goes out as to what I've studied to the to the fundamentalists, the sane fundamentalists, people like Ogden Kraut, just a wonderful man. Now, Ogden Kraut wouldn't, in what I saw of him, that he would never try to exalt himself. And my heart goes out to them, too, because Orson Pratt said, Joseph Smith will be a future immortal messenger. Joseph Smith will be the one mighty and strong. I think we're about wrapped up. Anything else?
What's the quote on that?
I'll give you I have 7 copies of the paper. If you want to come up, I've got it documented. Yes. He says that in the footnotes in the Doctrine and Covenants from 1879 to 1920. And he says it specifically in a discourse. Yes, sir.
I'm going to make a speech for that. When in my growing up years in the church, when I was in my mid-20s, just come back from a mission, why, there was an occurrence of sort of an appeal to direction toward finding mighty and strong by a group of missionaries in France, as I understand. You came along after that, I think. And I think Levina can probably tell us about it. But one of the, I think the second counselor in the mission presence, he was a fellow named Tucker. Is that right? I don't remember his first name, but he was going around the mission as second counselor and sort of meeting with missionaries and preaching to those who might be interested in the idea that there was a mighty and strong. And it was it LeBaron that was, or was he the mighty and strong? I don't know.
He hooked up with the LeBaron.
Yeah, but the one mighty and strong was Benjamin F. Johnson.
But
of course Benjamin Johnson was dead by then.
Well, yes, but his priesthood was still with the LeBarons.
Right.
They said he was the one mighty and strong.
Except Irvin LeBaron also later claimed to be the one mighty and strong, so it's one of those shifting titles.
I'm just wondering what happened to that sort of mini movement, because I don't know how many missionaries left France excommunicated and went and joined up with them, and I wonder.
Could we just have a wrestling match to sell this?
Yes.
A tournament? I talked to Earl LeBaron's brother, I forget his name, he was the head of the church at first. Benjamin. Joel LeBaron. He claims to be the one by the strong, and he was alive. And I asked him if he was.
Well, I think it's a really, as Bill has pointed out, I think it's really a fascinating litmus test. You have an ambiguous scripture that does establish that something needs to be set in order and nominates and leaves the category open. And I think it's really interesting how people read themselves into that scripture and then play out scenarios that the mention of the LeBarons should convince us can be not only spiritually lethal, but also pretty physically lethal as well. Thank you very much for your good-humored participation.